Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
We've got a packed show today. Two recipes for syrups with fresh herbs to drizzle over cantaloupe and raspberries. We speak to the farmers who grew that fruit. The folks at Harvest Public Media explore the real impact food miles have on your carbon footprint. And author Daniel Tucker speaks about his book that profiles farmers all over the country who are changing the way we experience food. But first, here's Mia Partlow with a look at this week's news.
After endless criticism about enticing kids to eat its unhealthy fast food by pairing it with toys and calls for its red-headed and floppy-shoed spokesman to retire, McDonald's has made a change to how it feeds children. Coming in September, Happy Meals will now automatically be served with a quarter cup of apple slices, and the serving size of French fries will be cut in half to 1.1 ounces. According to restaurant analyst Peter Soleil, this is a publicity stunt. He says, quote, if you sell more Happy Meals, you're likely selling more Big Macs to the parents. The USDA's Food and Safety Inspection Service has proposed a rule that would change the way packaged meat is labeled. As it stands now, a package of raw chicken breast and a package of chicken breast enhanced with a solution can both be labeled as chicken breast, even if the latter is 60% chicken and 40% solution. The new rule proposes that labels now state the percentage of added solution and the ingredients in the solution in a font, size, and color that are easily visible to consumers. The USDA reports that approximately 30% of poultry, 15% of beef, and 90% of pork are enhanced with solutions, and usually those solutions are high in sodium. And Michelle Obama and the Partnership for a Healthier America recently announced a proposal to build and expand more grocery stores in American food deserts. The idea is that an increased number of stores like Walmart, Walgreens, and SuperValue will provide fresh food to more Americans and help people to make healthier eating choices. However, critics assert that big box retailers will instead promote the unhealthy food in their stores, such as processed meals and soda. For more news like this, follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Just search for Earth Eats. For Earth Eats, I'm Mia Partlow.
This week, we're presenting the first part of a five-part series from Harvest Public Media about the local food system. Our food system is increasingly globalized. The food that reaches your local grocery store may have come from thousands of miles away. At the same time, the number of farmers markets in the country is skyrocketing. People are turning to local food for all sorts of reasons: freshness, social interactions, supporting the local economy, and because it doesn't travel as far, it's often viewed as a more environmentally friendly purchase. But that's not always the case. Kathleen Masterson has more.
I'm standing here in the grocery aisle in front of a wall of canned fruit. I'm going to pick up a can of these peaches. It says they're distributed out of San Francisco, but it doesn't say where they're from. It's quite likely they traveled thousands of miles to get here. But does that mean they used more energy, and producing them emitted more greenhouse gases than local peaches? Not necessarily.
You look at a can of peaches, and they were grown in either Spain or Greece, then shipped and packed in Thailand, and then sent back to the U.S., and that's 17,000 miles. I mean, I don't drive that much in a year in my car.
That's Rich Pirog. He and co-authors wrote a paper in 2003 that analyzed how far different foods travel to get to your plate. But Pirog says they never meant for these so-called food miles to be considered a measure of food's greenness.
We were very clear that food miles are a great indicator or metaphor of localness, but they're not a reliable indicator of environmental impact.
Consider those canned peaches from Spain, for example.
Could South Carolina peaches coming to Iowa be produced for a lower cost and a lower ecological footprint? The answer is it depends. You know, the mileage is not the driving factor.
So what is? Well, it turns out we expend the most energy in growing the food itself. That's according to a study by Scott Matthews, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. He studied all the energy we use to grow food, including things like tractor fuel, fertilizer, growing grain to feed animals. And he found if you look at the whole life cycle, 83% of our food's greenhouse gas emissions come from growing it. Transporting the food from farm to grocery, on average, is just 4% of the food's emissions.
You know, it really does matter what you eat, not where you get it from. If you're someone who cares about the greenhouse gas impact of your food, you should be thinking about diet changes, not localization.
Matthew's study found that even if you went totally local and magically got all your food from 0 miles away, you'd likely only reduce your contribution to greenhouse gas emissions by about 5%. You get a lot more mileage, so to speak, by changing what you eat.
The paper that we did and most of the message really is about thinking about cows versus non-cows in terms of reducing impact.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.
Over here at the deli counter, I'm standing next to some of the biggest energy use culprits. We've got T-bone steak, cowboy ribeye, New York strip steak. In fact, red meat is by far the biggest greenhouse gas emitter, any way you slice it.
Chili meat?
Chili meat?
Yeah.
How much do you need?
2 pounds.
According to Matthew's study, if the average American cut just 1 day a week of red meat out of their diet, it would have the same effect as if that person bought all their food locally for the whole year. I asked Matthews why red meat has such a big environmental footprint.
Both ends of the cow.
Manure and burping, as Matthews politely describes it, emit significant amounts of methane, which is a greenhouse gas 25 times more warming than carbon dioxide. And then there's the fuel used to grow and ship the corn the cows eat, and other emissions from the farm. So does that mean there's no compelling reason to buy local food? Not so fast. Matthew says he and co-author Chris Weber both buy from local farmers.
But we don't do it because what we're trying to do is reduce our carbon footprint. We do it because we're trying to support local agriculture. We're doing it because of freshness and all these other things.
Food Miles author Rich Pirog agrees. He says local food has many benefits that are hard to measure. It's often fresh and healthy, and many people enjoy shopping at farmers markets. And he says,
you know, many of our farmers in our farmers markets are using heirloom varieties, and so they're helping to preserve a wide genetic diversity, and that is an environmental benefit.
But if reducing your carbon footprint is your main concern, you'd do better buying apples from New Zealand than buying beef from down the road. I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
Hear part two of the five-part series next week when we explore how one urban farm is addressing social problems in St. Louis. In the meantime, learn about Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. When Daniel Tucker and his fellow authors were brainstorming for the book Farm Together Now, they realized that they weren't capable of contributing to the conversation analyzing the problems with the food system. So instead, they focused on meeting people all over the country who are experimenting with solutions for the broken food system. What they came up with is a series of farmer profiles, from urban farms addressing the issues of food deserts to small rural farms that are trying to rebuild healthy soil.
And that was really our kind of primary concern in selecting people, was thinking about how to represent kind of the widest range of people that are engaging in kind of food-related activism today.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the people. One guy, David Myers of On the Fly Farms in Michigan. There's a graphic in the book that has a list of the expenses and then the list of income. And it matches up. It's equal. So no profit for this farm whatsoever. Did you find that a lot of farmers were operating with that sort of budget sheet?
David was unique in that he calculated in his farm business ledger a cost that most people don't account for, and that is really what drew us to David, and that is a solidarity subsidy.
Yeah. What?
And what he means by that is that he's going to ask urban people that he knows in the Chicago area. He's a farmer in southwestern Michigan, just right around the bend of Lake Michigan, and he sort of insists or requires that the people that buy his food pay a little extra so that he can give a certain percentage of it away in low-income communities throughout the city. And David was the only person in the book that operated that way, though I can say, you know, pretty definitely while everyone was had different kind of economic situations, that they were all committed in some way to something that might be called solidarity, and that they were sort of using food as a tool to basically engage people around a whole host of issues.
Well, I'm curious to talk a little bit more about the concept of the solidarity fund, where people give a little bit more so that other people can have healthy foods. So this seems to be working on a very small scale for this one guy's farm. Can this work on a large scale? Could this be a large-scale solution for our country's food system problems?
I don't think that model is going to scale up very big. That's true. And that's an important thing to recognize, is a lot of these experiments, they work quite well and they're quite admirable and inspiring on a small scale. And as you start to scale them up, you know, the contradictions start to show through more, or the complexity starts to show through more. But that stuff's always there, and it just is, you know, a little easier to work around on a small scale. And so I think that some of the models that are introduced in the book can be scaled up, but in particular, I would say the people who are organizing themselves as cooperatives. There's a long history of agricultural and food related cooperative businesses in the U.S., and that's something that we can draw from. And the cooperative structure allows for a kind of subtle but meaningful shift in the way that the economics of food or any business work.
Before we get too far away from the economics of food, let's talk about farm subsidies, because this is big in the news. Lawmakers are thinking about cutting farm subsidies. From your perspective, is this a good thing for the American food system?
I personally don't think that subsidies are the problem. I think where the subsidies go and the sort of logic that drives and kind of orients the subsidies is the problem. I mean, I think that, you know, the government has a responsibility to regulate the market. And, you know, that's not a view that everyone shares by any means, but that's my perspective. But how that regulation takes place is, you know, the important details that have to get worked out. And so if more subsidies could go to encourage smaller scale sustainable agriculture, I think that would be a great thing.
Well, okay, so now let's shift gears and go to California. City Slicker Farms. It's three urban farms, over 100 backyard farms. The book describes the folks that this farm serves as low income. They're having to deal with high crime, not a whole lot of jobs or opportunities in their area. And not only that, they have to deal with a lot of pollution and very little access to fresh foods. So let's talk a little bit more about the people on that farm.
Yeah, City Slickers is a really interesting model because unlike a lot of garden projects that exist in urban areas, they really insisted, the organizers insisted, that what they were doing was farming. So they weren't giving people plots so that they could grow a small amount of something to kind of mix in with their meals. They were actually going to produce on a much larger level, and everyone was going to kind of reap the benefits, but everyone was going to work the same lots together. And then they also have done really innovative things on a policy level with the initiation of the Oakland Food Policy Council, which was, I believe, the first in the country on a sort of major metropolitan scale where they developed an actual food policy agenda for a city. And that's an idea that has taken off and inspired cities like Chicago, where I'm from, and all across the U.S. And that policy tool set is a really important one because while the food system is integrated across, you know, the international territories, a lot of the way that distribution could work is going to happen on a really localized scale. And so creating certain subsidies either for markets and corner stores to carry fresh vegetables or for it to be easier for people to turn vacant lots into gardens, things like that, that's going to come from a food policy council on a urban or metropolitan scale. And they really kind of pioneered a lot of that work out in the Bay Area.
It sounds like also they're serving a food desert. Is this a solution for food deserts potentially on a larger scale, urban farms?
Urban farms are a piece of the solution for food deserts. But food deserts are simply a reflection of years of neglect of certain parts of cities across the U.S. and rural areas as well. Creating urban farms in and of themselves isn't the solution to reversing, you know, years of neglect, but it's a component. And I think that it's a powerful component in as much that it provides food, but also that it is a symbol. And it's a symbol that everyone can see that this land that people said wasn't worth anything and people didn't care about for years and years is now in a kind of community-controlled production. And it's a productive place and it's a hopeful place. And that's really important. And I really think that, you know, in order to change the food system, you kind of have to carefully consider what kind of transformations you want to see in both the kind of market and the economic relations as well as the sort of general culture.
When you're creating an urban farm, you obviously have to think about what plot of land you're going to take to create a farm out of. Soil is a living thing, and if you leave it alone for a really long time, you know, it might not necessarily be the best soil or best plot of land for growing food. Talk about some people that you spoke with that had to repurpose soil in the city or that had a hard time figuring out how to grow food in a certain spot.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think it's a big challenge in urban areas and also in rural areas because people have grown the same plants and vegetables on rural farmland for way too long and have not cared for their soil. And it's a big problem everywhere. And the group that I interviewed in central Missouri called Sandhill Farm, when they first got started, they made a lot of mistakes. But then when they finally realized that actually what they were doing was not farming, that they were just growing good soil, good healthy soil, and they kind of shifted their mentality to put the emphasis on the soil and not necessarily on the bounty, that their farming practices became actually a lot more successful.
In 10 years, where do you see the farming system in this country?
I think in 10 years, there is a real chance that we have right now, if we take advantage of this moment, that we're going to be eating a lot more food that is produced nearby us and have a lot greater sensitivity to where our food comes from and how far it's traveled to get to us and also what is possible in the different climates that we inhabit across this geographically vast country that we live in. And I think that that's going to happen sort of for two reasons. The sort of more negative reason is because I think it's just going to have to happen because food prices are soaring across the world and the kind of logic that we use to organize how we ship grain and vegetables across, you know, oceans is that's not going to be able to last forever. And then the more hopeful reason is because I think people are recognizing the real joy in relating to food, each other, land in a different way that's kind of been forgotten. I think that it's something that we can not only kind of get back to in a historical sense, but also develop and reconceive, you know, and think about, well, how does a sort of healthy, fair, sustainable local food system look today when over half the world's population lives in cities and there's, you know, real economic and environmental crisis to be concerned about. And I think that people are doing a great job of experimenting with solutions to those kind of challenges right now. And what I am hopeful for in order to get to a better place in 10 years is that people will start to put their heads together a little bit more and think about kind of some shared principles and values that we can sort of push forward with together.
Cool. Daniel Tucker, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Read the complete interview on our website, eartheats.org. Michael Pollan called Farm Together Now his favorite book of 2010. If you want to enter to win a copy of this book, keep an eye on our Twitter feed and Facebook page this coming week for details. Just search for Earth Eats. To the kitchen now. We bought some raspberries and melons from the market, and we're going to make some herb-infused sauces to drizzle on top.
When you think of herbs, a lot of times you think of savory things, but they're great to make syrups with. So today we're going to make two different syrups that you can use for breakfast or actually throughout the whole day. A simple syrup is very easy. I'm just measuring out the sugar. I've got 1 cup of sugar. And I'm putting another cup in another pan. Okay, and then we're just going to put the equal amount of tap water. So we add a cup of tap water to each pot. And you bring that to a boil. All right, and that's basically how you make a syrup. So I've got these both on, and now what I'm going to do is to flavor them. And I'm going to make one that's going to be a thyme syrup, and the other one is going to be a mint syrup.
So with the thyme, you just threw everything in. You didn't take the time to pick off the little leaves.
Didn't take the time. It's, yeah, that's about a, I would say if you're going to go to the supermarket, it'd be about a half bunch of thyme still on the twigs, and that will allow me to remove it easily. So what we want to do is to get the essential oils and flavors out of the thyme, and then we'll pull those herbs out, and then if we want to, we can decorate the final dish with some fresh thyme or mint. So I got a nice handful of that. Now we just were out in the garden. We picked some mint. I think with the raspberry, we will go with a nice, strong peppermint. So peppermint has kind of long, elongated leaves. It'll have a really nice, punchy flavor. So I'm just going to give these guys a rinse.
Obviously, you're very experienced with these herbs. But looking at this plate, I can't tell one thing from the next.
Well, follow your nose. Rub them between your fingers. There are some mints that are a little more pungent, a little more savory, which will be great in salads and pestos and that kind of thing. So you want to use those more sweeter, like the chocolate mint or the spearmint or the peppermint in your syrups and your sweet dishes. All right, we're going to add a little more depth of flavor to these. With the thyme, I'm going to add just a little bit of lime zest. So I've got the microplane. And I'm just going to rub the lime across that, releasing those essential oils. You get that nice citrusy flavor.
Something about lime goes especially well with thyme.
I really like lemon thyme, which is a type of plant. It's a variety of thyme. The fragrance really works well with the kind of earthiness of the regular thyme. So it kind of is a natural match. I'm going to add about a half lime worth of juice as well. And what that will do is cut back on the kind of the sweetness of it, and you know that acidity will play nicely with the melon. To finish the mint syrup, we're going to do orange. So you could also use lemon. Let me just turn down this heat now that we've come to a full boil and the sugar's dissolved. You can grow an orange mint. So I'm kind of playing off that with the little orange zest and the juice of half an orange. And then to really get those flavors to come out, I'm just going to add a tiny pinch of salt to each of these, which I do a lot with all my sweets. And you don't want to have enough that you really taste the salt, but you want enough to kind of open up your taste buds a little bit, and you'll be able to enjoy the other flavors even more.
The syrups are as simple as that. Check out photos of the prep process and the finished dishes on our website. And while you're online, add your kitchen creations to our Flickr page. From eartheats.org, scroll down to the bottom right and click Add Your Photos. I stopped by the local market to chat with the farmers who grew the cantaloupe and berries we're using in these dishes.
Well, I've got sweet corn, cucumbers, green beans, zucchini, blackberries, cantaloupes.
That's Carl Van Antwerp, who's been farming his whole life. We'll be enjoying his cantaloupe with a thyme and lime syrup.
Yes, this is our first week for them at the market. Oh, we should have them probably into September. Well, we start our plants out in a greenhouse, our little transplants, and then we transplant them into the field usually early May. Of course, we have to fertilize them and irrigate them, and we have to spray for bugs once in a while. No more than we have need to, but we do have to sometimes. The blackberry is probably another 2 weeks maybe. It's kind of a short season on the blackberries.
Another vendor, John Allen Flynn, forages for his berries.
Well, a lot of them I find on my farm. Various ones I find neighbors' farms. These here, I think I actually found where my son works. They have a small pond, and he said they had a bunch of big blackberries there, so I picked them there.
Listen to other farmer profiles and interviews on our website, eartheats.org. Back to the kitchen where the syrups are ready. Chef Orr is preparing the cantaloupe.
And what you do is you take the skin down to where you see that nice orange color, and you just kind of let that be your guide. But you can save all of these peelings for the compost, so don't throw anything away. And then what a lot of people do is they cut the melon in half and take the seeds out and then try to peel it, but it's much easier to peel it whole and then cut it in half and scoop it out. So just taking all the seeds out, and these will also go in the compost. A lot of times you'll get little volunteer cantaloupes growing out of your compost, and sometimes I just let them go and see if they'll produce anything. You also get a lot of times pumpkin seeds will be another thing you'll throw in the compost, and the next year you'll get a bunch of little pumpkins growing out of the middle of the compost heap.
So that sounds equal parts disgusting and awesome to have melons growing out of your compost. Would you eat something that grew out of the compost?
Absolutely. Well, the compost is used in your garden. It makes some of the best fertilizer in your garden. Okay, what we're going to do now is just slice some of this very thin. In the restaurant, we give it a fancy name. We'd call it a carpaccio, which is traditionally done with meat.
The smell of cantaloupe is immediately summer to me.
We get some real good cantaloupe in southern Indiana. There's some good sandy soil around, and perfect kind of summer food for us Hoosiers. Now I'm just going to take that thyme and lime syrup and spoon that over the top. Garnish it with a little flowering thyme, and you can decorate it with some other berries if you'd like. We've got some currants here. A nice kind of contrast to the sweet melon. We've also got some gooseberries.
All right. I've never knowingly had a gooseberry. Explodes in your mouth.
You see, there's two different colors. There's the green ones, which I like them even better than the riper ones.
Yeah, they're a little tart.
Yeah, this is really real sour. And then they kind of mellow out. Here's one of the riper purple ones. Yeah. It's called a gooseberry. So you take off the beak. You can see it has this little beak. And then the tail. So you take off the beak and the tail before you use them.
They remind me of baby tomatillos. That's so funny. Yeah, they have that same like Japanese lantern look to them.
Uh-huh. All right, so we put the raspberries in a nice bowl, and we're just going to spoon some of this warm mint and orange syrup over the top.
Yeah, still steaming.
Sometimes with fresh fruit, especially if it's a little underripe, if you have one of these syrups and you spoon it over while it's still warm, it kind of permeates the fruit a little bit more. So if you have some peaches that may not be, you know, quite there, or your melon seems a little bit, you know, bland. Sometimes supermarket or wintertime melons are a little bit bland. If you have some of these syrups around that you made in the spring and summer, you can use that all year round and put them over, you know, supermarket fruit, and it'll bring back the flavor of the summer.
I remember one of the syrups you made last time we were here was a lemon verbena syrup, I think, which was absolutely delicious. You put that over strawberries.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's another good one. You can also use that lemon verbena syrup. You could, make a cocktail with it. You could do a blender drink with it. So instead of just adding plain sugar, which really only adds sweetness, you're adding a depth of flavor and more intrigue to your cooking.
Well, that's a good point, that these simple syrups can be used in beverages.
Yeah, alcoholic beverages, or you can just keep a carafe full of one of these syrups and sweeten your tea with it.
Mix and match with other seasonal fruits. Try serving these dishes as a refreshing dessert. Let us know how you use these syrups in your cooking. Or just let us know what you thought of this episode. Drop us an email at eartheats@gmail.com.
Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop.
Production support also comes from goodsforcooks.com. Online at goodsforcooks.com.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
And I'm Annie Corrigan. See you next time.